2:45 Central Time, 56 degrees in Urbana. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. No doubt there is something you own, some object that while it may not look like much, it means a lot to you. In our home, one such object is a porcelain cracker box. Its shape is square. It's pale green and painted with gold vines and flowers. It belonged to my maternal grandmother. As a child, I admired it. As an adult, it didn't look like much. But when I heard the story of how my grandmother came to own it, I hoped one day to own it. My grandmother was as honest as the day is long, but she wanted that cracker box. It was to go to the woman with the winning hand in a game of cards. Grandma cheated. In this portion of the program, my guest is Joshua Glenn. He's a writer and editor currently at the Boston Globe. He and Carol Hayes are the authors, or author of a new book from the Princeton Architectural Press. The title, Taking Things Seriously, 75 Objects with Unexpected Significance. Here you'll find objects much more interesting than my cracker box, a robot-shaped hairdo machine, a kitty jigsaw, TV-shaped pencil sharpener, a rubbery little yellow pig named Sunshine. And the owners of all these objects provide their backstory. Joshua Glenn, welcome to the program. Should I call you author or editor or what?
Yeah, I'm the editor.
Yeah, okay, very good. How did you and Carol Hayes come up with the idea for this book?
Well, I've been interested in significant objects that I find in the living rooms, kitchens, studies, offices, dens of my friends and, I'm a journalist, so, the homes and offices of interesting, imaginative, creative people that I've entered. You find some sort of really nondescript, almost ugly-looking thing displayed as though it's a precious vase or work of art, and you ask them about it, and there's always a great story. So one day, my friend Carol and I, Carol's a designer, were at a party, and we were looking at over somebody's trinkets, and they were telling us the great stories, and we said, we've got to do a book about this.
Yeah. Now, do you own an object that doesn't appear particularly valuable, but you display reverentially?
Yes. My object that I included in the book is a plaster death mask of the poet Baudelaire, who under whose grim visage I tried to write a book about Baudelaire once for 2 years, and practically went bankrupt doing it. And it turns out later that it wasn't actually a death mask of Baudelaire at all. It's a life mask of Keats. that object has a lot of meaning for me.
Yeah. Tell us about, I mentioned the robot hairdo machine. This is an object that belongs to an architect, which is interesting. His name is Henry Scollard.
Yes. Hank was walking out of his office one day in downtown Boston, and he sees this hairdo, sort of, I think it was a prototype, some kind of hairdo machine, hair dryer, hair blower. It's kind of hard to tell what it does. It has these mysterious appendages and a rudimentary, crude computer screen, and it's very dangerous. You can plug it in, and it becomes incredibly hot right away, and you can see where they threw it away. But it looks sort of like a robot, so Hank swept it up with him as he went down the sidewalk and took on a train and was immediately mobbed by young women who wanted to meet the robot. He realized it was a chick magnet. So he and the robot are actually, I think, roommates. And the way Hank talks about it, I think the robot's one of his best friends, too.
That's sad.
Yeah.
This robot-looking hairdo machine, it has, like, arms. It kind of looks like arms.
Yeah, I don't think they intended it to be a robot, but maybe it was too sinister for the ladies in the hair salon, and they got rid of it, and now it's Hank's prized possession.
Yeah. It does raise the question of how things like this, how an object like this gets designed. Who designed this?
Yeah.
I'm sure there's lots of great stories.
Well, one of my great interest in these objects was the stories. Carol, the designer, actually, her great interest, and one of the reasons the book is very attractive looking, is that she didn't want it to just be objects that were very cool looking, that anyone would value and snatch up if they saw it in a junk store. She loves the fact that a lot of people have extremely ugly and badly designed objects that they prize, especially nowadays when everything is so well designed. Everything in Target is gorgeous, and furniture is supposedly within modern design furniture is within reach of somebody, not me, but somebody. And so she was very attracted to the idea that you know, a lot of things over the years have made it through, have made it onto shelves without going through the endless design process these days that you have that ensures that everything looks tasteful and stylish.
Yeah, one of the things that I'm not quite sure, I don't know how to describe this. Maybe you can do a better job. There is apparently kind of a game object, Rocking Crazy Duck with Magic Wand. Never wears out, works on land or in water. And this goes back, must go back to the 40s or 50s.
Yeah, that's, you know, there's an example of, you know, something that's being appreciated for the wrong reasons. I think at the time it was put out, it was just a really fun use of magnets. I believe what it is a duck with a magnet inside, and you wave a little magnetic wand under a table and the duck rocks. And people who are looking don't know why the duck is rocking back and forth, but you are manipulating it with a magnet. At the time, that probably seemed really, you know, scientific or, you know, a great magic trick or something. But this person came along 40 years later and sees it hanging on a, you know, dusty and still for sale on a shelf in some random side of the highway.
At a rest stop.
And he loves the fact that it says, you know, amazing, electric, full of energy, never stops. And to him it became his talisman of energy. And now whenever he needs a boost and feels like he's lagging, he looks at the duck and thinks, okay, if the duck can keep going, I can keep going.
Yeah.
So people, you know, people purposely have or semi-purposely misappropriate objects and value them for all the wrong reasons, which is fine.
And this Rocking Crazy Duck, Mystifying Fun, belongs to a fellow by the name of Rob Carmichael. Tell us a little bit about the contributors to the book. Are they friends, and how did you decide that's in? No, I'm willing to leave that one out.
How did we pick the contributors?
Yeah.
The original thought was, you know, I'm a journalist and a writer. I figured, you know, I would contact 20 writer friends, and even if their objects didn't look that fantastic, they'd write a good essay about it. And Carol would contact 20 designer and artist friends, and they would probably have great-looking objects, even if they couldn't write that well about them. As it turns out, the writers had a lot of cool-looking objects, and the designers could write really well, so that worked out well. And then we had 40 people. We sold the book on the basis of that, and then we went out and got 35 more people by contact. We asked those people, our contributors, to give us names of people, and we sort of cast our net out. We sent out emails, and we ended up getting a few well-known people, like Bill Griffith, the creator of the comic strip Zippy, sent us a bottle from which he got the Zippy logo for his comic strip. And Tom Frank, author of What's the Matter with Kansas, sent us a World War I helmet that reminds him of the futility of going to war.
Mm.
And other people well-known in my world, not necessarily well-known to your audience, but I was very pleased with the contributors we ended up getting. So I didn't know about half of them or more.
Yeah. What, taken as a whole, what do these objects and their owners' brief essays have to tell us?
What I think is fascinating about what I've discovered through editing this book is that here we are, these enlightened 21st century civilized people who still find ourselves attracted to objects, or maybe find objects, you know, sucking us towards them, as though we were still, you know, primitive people. We gather these things as fetishes, as totems, as relics, as, you know, sacred mementos and relics, in a way that supposedly, you know, we're not that way anymore. But here we are, fetishizing these inanimate things that aren't really talking to us, but yet we seem to feel that we can communicate with them, or they have something to say to us.
Yeah.
So I find that fascinating.
What does it say, or what kind of clues does it provide in terms of how we come to impart meaning to things, to objects?
Well, this is one of the great unanswerable questions of philosophy: is do we place meaning on the world? Do we impose meaning on the world around us, or is meaning already there and it's up to us to discover it? Is meaning something that's discovered or invented? Nobody has ever come up with one final answer on that one yet. I sort of come down somewhere in the middle of that. I feel that that's my relationship to my object. It's sort of something that seems to be speaking to me on its own, and on the other hand, I know that I'm placing my own feelings and emotions onto it.
Hmm. Speaking of what does it mean, there's an object in the book provided by Jen Collins. It's a tank T-shirt that she decorated with some iron-on letters, And the iron-on letters pressed onto the shirt say, "Love is not enough," all in capital letters. And when I saw that photo, I thought, what does that mean?
Yeah, Jen, she's a friend of mine from Boston, and she lives in California now, but she was back in town. Her mother was dying of cancer, and there's nothing anyone could do about it, and Jen was just kind of living with her for the last few months of her mother's life. And one day while she took her mom to a hair appointment, because, you know, even though her mother was dying, she wanted to look nice, Jen was sort of browsing through in a craft store, and she, you know, having all these conflicted emotions and sorrow about the situation that her mother was in and the sort of absurdity of taking her to a hair salon appointment. And so she created this T-shirt that kind of, you know, it's her reminder. So, like, some people might get a tattoo to remind them of a certain realization they've had in their life. She made a T-shirt to tell her that love is not enough. It's a heavy sentiment.
Mm-hmm. And nobody apparently asks her about it.
Yeah, people walk into her apartment and they see it there, and she has it hanging between two rooms, almost like a curtain you have to go past to get in, or to get into a closet or to a room. And I think people recognize it as something heavy, and they don't, you know, people are too polite to ask, you know, what are you feeling so heavy about?
Yeah, it's all in capital letters, and apparently one friend of hers said it looks like a warning.
Right, yeah, I mean, if that was the only way that you felt about anything in life, then you probably wouldn't leave your apartment much and feel depressed. So it's probably more dire than she feels most of the time. But she wanted to remind herself of having felt that way.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite piece in the book?
There are so many good ones. I don't know if I have a favorite. I really like my co-editor Carol's. She has a sampler that her aunt knitted, and it has the word thoughts on it, surrounded by flowers. And every time I've been to Carol's apartment, people just stand around staring at the sample, trying to figure out what it means. Why would you embroider the word thoughts? Spend your time doing that, because are you trying to get people who look at it to think thoughts or to think about thoughts? Or it becomes a bottomless loop of confusion. I think Carol actually finally had to put it away because it was distracting people too much when they came over to her house.
Yeah.
There's a lot of nice objects that are sort of crystallize a relationship between people, between, you know, a father and his child who asked him to bring back a clam shell or a mussel shell, even though the dad was going to Texas, where you wouldn't think you'd find something like that.
Mm.
But in fact, he did find something like that. Or, a paperweight that was left behind by a woman whose boyfriend later killed himself, and the paperweight is something that he had scavenged from the trash and reminded her of this wonderful way he had of reusing things and feeling that we lived in a culture of overconsumption. So I really like those objects that tell you something about a little moment in the life, in the relationship between two people.
Yeah. There we have to wrap up, Joshua. Thank you for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you so much for having me.
Joshua Glenn is a writer and editor currently at the Boston Globe. He and Carol Hayes are the co-editors of a new book from the Princeton Architectural Press. The title, Taking Things Seriously, 75 Objects with Unexpected Significance.